Greetings and welcome to the season finale of Trinity Radio. I am Jonathan Pritchett, and along with me is
Braxton Hunter.
And we are excited to finally be done with this season. We're forgiven, we're shown mercy and grace, and our punishments probably aren't as harsh as they should be, even within this lifespan.
Do skeptics bring objections to the case? Of course they do. What's going on with you today?
They just don't like it. They don't like it that God is just and he has every right as creator to do what he will.
God is the best explanation for the beginning of the universe.
Of now y'all having to look at our faces, which for that I apologize.
It is the season finale of Trinity Radio. This is season 7, episode 22.
Yes.
Now some of you might be thinking, are you guys just making up some of these seasons?
No.
Well, yes. Maybe some of them. I don't know. Basically what happened was there were a few years before when I did this podcast completely alone. And then there were a few years I did it with a guy named Nathan Williams. And then there was a little time where I did it alone again, and now Pritchett's with me. And if you count up all those with 22 episodes or something, you get basically now 7 seasons.
Yeah, except so, this is the longest streak ever.
We've never been this consistent before.
You were never this consistent. That's right. You and Nathan were never this consistent, and you and I have never been this consistent. But I'll tell you what it is. It's all this that
we got official.
That, yes.
And you, the listening audience, began communicating with us and telling us what you thought, and we have developed a little community online. And if this is your first time hearing an episode of Trinity Radio, take heart. Don't feel bad because this season is over. Because for one thing, we don't plan on taking too long of a break between seasons. But on top of that, there's a whole backlog of episodes that you can go get. And there are even more on BraxtonHunter.com/podcast than there are on iTunes for some reason. So you can go back and get all of those and just listen till your heart's content.
And it's not like we won't have any content. We're going to be having...
We'll still be putting out the Bible studies.
And I'll be starting my First Peter study.
And I'll be putting out the topical videos, although I have not... I've been inconsistent about that the past few weeks because I've been so busy, but I have some coming in the near future. So look,
and we've got other stuff coming down the pike too, some new stuff.
There's lots of stuff on youtube.com/BraxtonHunter for you to check out. Yeah. There's lots of stuff with the podcast. There's lots of stuff elsewhere. And so don't worry. And if you're new to the podcast, by the time you get done listening to the back catalog, we'll probably be already started with the second season or the 8th season. So, but what we thought about for what we should discuss today is we decided that we are sick of the soteriology debate.
Yes.
If you don't know what we're talking about, maybe you've heard of Calvinism and Arminianism and all that. Well, pretend you didn't hear of them because we're sick of that argument.
Yes.
We're glad that there are people out there like James White and Leighton Flowers who that's a thing that they're passionate about, and they have at it, boys. But for us, we're tired of it. And so much so that I went into the Trinity College of the Bible and Theological Seminary roundtable group and said, we're putting a moratorium on discussions about this in this group. At the Trinity Radio page, feel free to talk about it. Just don't expect us to contribute.
Right. It's just gotten so... Look, I have changed my views in the past, but I don't think I'm at the point where I'm going to hear anything new on this. Mm-hmm. In my upcoming debate, I say I'm sick of it, and yet here I am going to be debating with it. But I was asked. I'm not going to hear anything new that's going to change my mind. Mm-hmm. If I can help somebody change their mind in this upcoming debate, great. If not, they're probably mostly like me anyway. They're just kind of set where they are. Whatever.
There's no one like you.
Yeah, there's no one.
But here's the thing. Let's not get into it because... We're sick of it. Yeah. We're sick of it. So what we decided to do also, I'm sick of the relationships that have been destroyed over this issue. But here's the thing. The second we realized this, we began to think, what have we missed? What has been missed in the world of theology that we theology geeks would love to talk about, but that we haven't been talking about because we've been arguing about the Calvinism debate? And a few things came to our minds. Yes. I thought of open theism, which can be connected to that soteriology debate, but not necessarily.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. That's really theology proper, your doctrine of God.
Right.
And related to that was also, underneath the surface, there was a big blow-up over the Trinity, but most people were too...
So open theism, yeah. The Trinity, we'll explain what all these things are. Open theism, the Trinity.
Eschatology.
You guys are always wanting us to talk about eschatology.
Yeah.
Charismaticism.
Yeah. There's...
Hell. Doctrine of hell.
Yes. Ecclesiology.
The nature of Genesis 1.
Yeah. There's all these things rumbling out there, but I think people have stuck to the Calvinism debate and ignored those things because it means they have to learn something new and more in depth. I think that was especially the case with the Trinity thing. People don't realize how big and important that debate was, and it's still kind of going on, but it did blow up in the last couple of years because the Trinity's complicated. And people say, well, I can state my opinion on the internet or in a debate about soteriology because that's all I care about, you know, whether you're an Arminian, traditionalist, Molinist, open theist, Calvinist, Catholic, whatever. Going to learn something new because that's not what's everywhere, but it is important. Same thing with continuationist, cessationist debate. I mean, it was, what, less than 5 years ago that we had the Strange Fire Conference, and that just kind of made the discussion happen, and then it just went away, and it's back to soteriology because nobody wants to get into it. Same thing with eschatology. I mean, people used to be obsessed with eschatology, 25 years ago.
So,
and nobody really gets into it anymore.
It occurred to me that these things are important because when I went to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary last January to speak at their Defend conference, some of these younger apologetics, younger guys who are interested in theology and apologetics and all these sorts of things, they began to kind of swarm because I was one of the speakers, and some of them knew me from stuff online. But they began to ask me, where do you stand on this? Where do you stand on that? They all knew where I stood on that other issue. They want to know where I stood on some of these other things, like the age of the earth and all these kind of things. Began talking with them, and this at New Orleans and then at a couple of other places, I've been surprised at the views that have emerged. I was telling someone the other day, it used to be the case that you could be old earth and that really wasn't that big of a deal, but you could not be open theist. That was rank heresy in most people's minds. But with a couple of these younger guys, old earthism is heresy. It's a young earth, but open theism's fine. It's completely changed.
At a Southern Baptist Seminary.
Yeah. It's unbelievable how things have changed. And most of these guys are just feeling through it. They haven't staked a claim, but still, it's there. You can tell where they're leaning. And that's a big thing among young seminarians right now. Is I think open theism. By the way, if you don't know what we're talking about, we do have an episode where we went into open theism in more detail. But open theism is basically the belief that God does not know what will happen in every case, either because he can't know, because that's unknowable, or because he chooses not to know.
Yeah, most of them would say it's just logically impossible to know future contingents.
Right.
And
those aren't things.
But God knows everything and that he knows all possibilities. Mm-hmm. Which, again, that's a logic question. I don't agree with open theism, but to the chagrin of some people and to the delight of others, I don't consider it rank heresy. It's okay. I don't get upset by it. It's not any worse than Calvinism to me. So,
well, it doesn't scare me. And I'll tell you something that some preachers who listen to our show, because there are a lot of preachers that have had me come preach at their churches who listen to the show, I'll just tell you that things like that, a younger Braxton Hunter, when he was 21 years old, would have said, "You're going to hell, man. There's a special place in hell for you."
Yeah.
And now people have various views on hell, and I'm like, I still think you're saved. Wrongness does not always reduced to lostness.
Right.
And you can be wrong about things and still be saved.
I don't agree with open theism, but I don't agree with Calvinism. And yes, I don't think one is any worse or better than the other.
I don't know why you're talking about Calvinism again.
I'm just saying, I give open. Okay, it's interesting. with open theists, they don't like reducing everything to anthropopapism and say, well, you're just saying that the Bible has God saying something that's not true to the way he really is. Mm-hmm. He's just saying that to accommodate. But what does it mean? So they do have biblical arguments as well as philosophical arguments, like the logical impossibility of knowing future contingents,
right,
and so forth. So, I mean,
But do you think people compare open theism? I've heard a lot of people who seem new to the discussion say, well, open theism just sounds like Molinism, or Molinism sounds like open theism. Now, we'll explain Molinism in a minute. But do you think that's because there are some open theists who believe that God has this sense of middle knowledge about all that could be, but he doesn't necessarily know which of those
will be,
right? Yeah. So they've heard open theists talk that way, and they've heard Molinists talk that way, so they say Molinists are open theists. Which is a mistake,
but I read, and this is what Greg Boyd said to William Lane Craig in their debate in Divine Foreknowledge Four Views. He says they are, I can't remember the term that he used, but either potential counterfactuals or creaturely freedom instead of just counterfactuals or creaturely.
Yeah, like possible. These could be.
Yeah.
And they really could be.
And he said, and Boyd's argument was that God knows reality exactly as it is, which means those are all possible.
Right. So let me
explain.
But
not any one of them is actual until it actually happens.
That's my computer. I do this every time, don't I?
Yeah.
Let me explain to you what Molinism is in a nutshell. And this is not going back to the soteriology debate, because Molinism is not all about soteriology.
Right, there are Calvinist Molinists,
right,
too.
Right, right.
Molinism is that...
I don't know why you're talking about Calvinism again.
Molinism is omniscience. If you don't... at least middle knowledge is just another way of saying God is actually...
So there's some new Trinity student who is a youth pastor who... this is brand new. All theology is brand new to him, at least on the seminary level.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and explain this.
Okay. God knows everything, and by everything, we mean everything.
So Molinism, most people are familiar with the idea that God knows all future and past events.
Yes.
Before there was
a future or a past event in creation.
Right. He knows that he exhaustively knows it.
And eternity passed before he brought about creation. He knew all future and past.
And we call that omniscience, right? And it is. However, what the Molinist will say
is God knows even more than that.
Yeah, God knows.
It's really omniscience.
Yeah, God knows. What we're saying is he not only knows all that will happen and all that has happened, he knows what would have happened under other circumstances.
And what could happen.
For example, and I've run this through with
he
many
knows
church
what
people.
Could have been's and would have been's and will be's and could be's.
I've run this through with a lot of church people. Yeah. I've said, let me ask you a couple of questions here. Do you believe God knows everything? Yes. Past, present, future. Yes. Do you think that God's omniscience is such that if you and I had not decided to have this conversation, but had, I'd gone and got my car and left, do you think he knows what I would be doing right now if I'd done that? Well, yeah. Most people say yeah.
Great.
Could he be wrong about that?
No.
Well, no, he's God.
Right.
Okay, well, then you believe in middle knowledge, because that's middle knowledge.
Right.
Middle knowledge is a fancy term for saying God knows what you would have done under other circumstances.
Yes.
So, if you believe that much, you pretty well believe it.
Now, and I make the claim, that the wild claim, that if you deny God's middle knowledge, then you don't affirm omniscience.
Yeah, but some people would just say what you've said about something else, which is you're trying to pay God too high of a compliment. That sounds all pious for you to say that,
right,
but it still might not be true.
Well, they would say, but anyone who objects to middle knowledge being true is making the same argument based on logic that open theists are making on logic, that if you say that's not logically knowable, well, then you have kind of got yourself in a catch-22 with the open theist who says, yeah, but neither is exhaustive foreknowledge.
Question I would ask the church person is, I'd say, okay, so you believe all that. Do you think God would have taken that knowledge into account when he created the world? And most of them will say, well, yeah, that mattered to God.
And we know that he did when he talked to David. We know that he did. Okay.
So, therefore, now that's all, that's putting it simply, all right?
Yeah.
What people often object to about Molinism is that it sounds so complex and sci-fi and philosophical. They're not talking about it simply stated, like we would just said. They're talking about when philosophers and theologians do articulate in a technical way, what has just been said. If you believe what we've just said, that's not really that crazy.
No.
It sounds a little difficult when you say it like this. That means that God is aware of all possible worlds. And when we say possible worlds, we don't mean these sci-fi real worlds out there somewhere.
Or
we're saying theoretical worlds that don't exist, and most of them never will exist. It's just worlds that, if they existed, they don't have any contradictions in them. Right? So Pritchett, there's nothing contradictory about believing that Pritchett, it could have been that Pritchett was born without a left arm.
Or that's Pritchett is actually Pritchett Prime in another...
Yeah, there's not if
another
it, yeah, it's world. Possible there's a world where Jonathan Pritchett does not exist, but a robot that is very lifelike.
And
this
mean.
Is getting weirder. I'm trying to state it simply. a world that doesn't have anything contradictory in it. For example, a world that is populated only by married bachelors.
That is
an impossible world.
Right. Can't.
Because married bachelors are impossible. They are contradictory. They're incoherent. They can't exist.
Right.
A world where music never exists, that's a possible world. It's a sad world, but it's a possible world, right? So you got all these possible worlds, and we're saying God actualizes or chooses to create one that he knows that you know, most Molinists would say that most lines up with his goals, the best of possible worlds,
right,
or whatever. So that's Molinism, basically. There's a lot more that could be said. Somewhere way, way back in the archives, I did a whole show on Molinism.
Right.
That's Molinism. We could have been talking about Molinism this whole time. We could have been talking about open theism this whole time. We could have been talking about what? What else could we have been talking about?
Well, you have been bugging me about not being as interested in eschatology as you, and it goes back to the fact that I haven't involved my... This, so I'm not just chastising everyone. I'm saying me. The reason why I'm not getting into this is because I have been too lazy to do the groundwork to get involved in the eschatology debate because, you know, even me too have been distracted by the soteriology
even
debate.
Even me too.
Even me too. Don't ever write that in a paper.
Yeah, that's
even
our
I
academic.
Myself have been...
No,
distracted.
You're an incredible wordsmith. That was just for comic.
Even I myself have been distracted by this debate.
Well, I'll tell you. Here's the thing. With eschatology, everybody knows, even on the last episode, I said there's been a long-standing rule that we don't talk about eschatology on this show.
Part of it is because your co-host doesn't know anything.
Well, here's the thing, though.
I mean, I default to my original, but I don't like to debate it and discuss it fluently.
But we recently had someone come teach here who holds to what is known as a partial preterist, amillennial view.
Yes.
Now,
semi-idealist.
That, you know, because normally when people hear you say, and now let me just say this, most of our professors are pre-trib, pre-millennial futurists.
Right.
But, so we've got one that's not, okay, chill out.
Two, I agree with him.
Well, but you don't talk about this.
Right.
You won't even talk about it on a podcast. So, but of people that talk about this, we've got one who's not a pre-trib, pre-millennial futurist. Right. But here's the thing. When most people hear you talk about, what do you think about eschatology? And they'll say, well, you know, or what do you think about Revelation? Let's say that. They'll say, what do you think about Revelation?
They usually say, what do you think about Revelations?
Yeah. They'll say, well, I'm a pre-trib, or I'm aware that there's post-trib, or mid-trib, or pre-wrath, or whatever. Or I'm premillennial or whatever. You know, most of those categories assume that that the book of Revelation is all talking about future events.
Yes.
Right? But that's one of four positions.
Yes.
There is the futurist view, the partial preterist view, the historicist view, the partial preterist view or the preterist view.
And the idealist view.
The preterist view says, I didn't finish the list because I decided to go back and explain. The preterist view says most of what's in Revelation happened is about AD 70. It was prophetic, but it was prophetic for the people of the time about what was about to happen.
Because Revelation was written in the 60s.
About the destruction of the temple in AD 70 and the sacking of Jerusalem. And actually all that happened in the Roman world around that time. That would be the preterist view. So this business that you think, that some people think are talking about future events, the preterist says, no, it's not talking about future events. It's talking about stuff that most of which is already done. Partial preterists would say, well, there is some stuff in Revelation that's talking about future events. And you know that's mostly in the latter.
Yeah, full preterism is heresy. Partial preterism is not.
Then historicism says it's neither past or future events, but the Book of Revelation is about the whole of church history. Right,
yes.
It's the whole deal. There aren't many historicists today. The Seventh-day Adventists are historicists, but there aren't too many others. And then you got the idealist view. You're aware of the futurist view. Then you've got the idealist view. The idealist view, do you want to articulate the idealist view briefly?
Well, I think G.K. Beale, and I would probably put David DeSilva, if going by his most recent short book on it, would be idealist in the sense that it has principles that were relevant to the first century church as well as universally relevant at all times and all places for the church, that it's not a book to decode to get something about either the whole sweep of human history in code or the future in code or however you want to the apocalypse idealistic interpretation is that the apocalypse is really about principles that matter to the original audience and will still matter to you, and it can be applicable at any time.
Packaging that a little differently, it's an example, a modern example of an idealistic or an idyllic writing would be like the Chronicles of Narnia. Nobody thinks there's actually a lion that named Aslan. Nobody actually thinks there's a white witch. But we recognize as we're reading through this thing that these represent things that do teach us lessons.
Right.
The difference being, or like Pilgrim's Progress, right? That's another example. Now, the difference being that Revelation, many people that are take an idealist view, would still see some historical things that actually... So you might have a partial preterist who has idealist leanings. But, the Chronicles of Narnia example, it's a book that is a drama with imagery on the idealist view.
Yeah.
That gives you realities that Christians need to know in any generation.
Right.
It teaches you things
you need. And treat it, though it's apocalyptic, treat it like you would Galatians, and then derive from what it meant to its original audience to what it means for us today, and don't get caught up in anything else. Now, you can also be an idealist and pair that with other views. So
most futurists are going to believe there's some idealist stuff there.
Yeah.
Now here's the thing that you do most need to know. We don't talk about eschatology that much, but there is one thing that has become a little bugaboo that I've gotten. I've always preached a futurist position on this. The thing that irritates me, though, that I used to say that I will never say again, and even when I said it, I felt uncomfortable with it, is people saying, the futurist people would say, we futurists, we take a literal view of Revelation. And not all of them do say this, but I did, and I'd heard other people I admire say this. Those preterists and those other folks, they don't take a literal view of Revelation. Okay, here's what I've realized. Both camps take some things literally and some things not literally.
Right.
And if you don't think so, next time you run into a futurist who talks that way, say to them, you take it literally? Yep, take it literally. Just read it literally. Okay, then do you think that Jesus, when you get there, is going to be a seven-eyed, seven-horned lamb slain there in heaven? Do you expect to see an animal Jesus? Well, no, of course not. That means the seven eyes are the seven spirits and blah, blah, blah. Right, you don't take it literally, right? That's the point.
That is the most useless word in talking about hermeneutics. Because I always tell in my hermeneutics class, I don't care how literal you take the Bible. I care how serious you take the Bible. And of course, when dispensationalists talk about literal human hermeneutics, they say, well, the literal view can account for metaphor and idioms and all of this.
Well, then you're just saying some of it's not literal.
Right. So,
right?
I mean, it just becomes the most silly, useless word.
I do care how literally they take the Bible. I care if the particular passage we're talking about is literal.
That's just saying
I want you to take it literally.
That's taking it serious.
Yeah, okay. You're saying take genre seriously.
Take the Bible seriously.
Yeah,
and
but the bottom line is we could have been talking about eschatology, and you wanted us to talk about eschatology. We could have been talking about the charismatic sign gifts. 2 years ago, I spent a summer because I decided, I've never deconstructed this thing. I've never decided. I've always been a typical Southern Baptist on these things, except a lot of Southern Baptists are cessationists. I've never been a cessationist because there's nothing, not one word in the Bible that indicates cessationism.
Right.
But I've not been a cessationist, but I've never spoken in tongues, for example. I've never miraculously been used of God to heal somebody. I've never, you know, spoken a prophecy the way they mean it, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So I decided I need to take a summer and I need to study the best, most academic treatment of this. Mm-hmm. So I contacted people that I admired and said, all right, who are charismatic. And I said, give me the best academic treatment you've got. There was one that was a Zondervan Counterpoints book. I forget, it's three views or four views or however many views on the miraculous sign gifts. That was pretty good. I'll give them that. I enjoyed that one. The charismatic in there, I enjoyed. That was probably the best. I don't remember who it was the best treatment I saw of their position. But the other book that somebody recommended to me, one of the other books, was Surprised by Joy by Jack Deere, who had been a Calvinist cessationist and ultimately became a charismatic. That book, to me, I didn't even have to read what a cessationist said in response to it. In reading through it, I could easily topple the case he was building.
Right.
I didn't, and that's, you know, and he's a thoroughgoing academic who taught academically before he ever was a charismatic. So, and if that's your favorite guy, look, don't take my word for it. It's me. I'm just telling you what I think.
Yeah.
I'm getting more cranky. It's fall. I don't want it to start getting cold.
I do.
I realize again this year I didn't lose as much weight as I expected to lose.
Me neither.
And Pritchett nearly died this year. And so, I'm not kidding. And so, I'm cranky, all right? So, I'm speaking more freely. I'm speaking a bit more like pseudo-Braxtonius than Braxton actual. But the bottom line is, we could have been talking about this business.
Yes.
We could have been talking about what else? What's left? We could have been talking about the
Trinity,
eternal subordination of the Son.
Yes.
There's a whole debate with Wayne Grudem and somebody else, Bruce Ware, versus two other guys or something. And that was a good debate. I enjoyed that debate.
Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Some other guys. I mean, yeah.
Well,
there's so many people all over this thing. I mean, you know, Malcolm Yarnell weighed in.
Oh, the Trinity.
Sanders, yeah.
Back on the Trinity. Because the eternal subordination.
Yeah,
of the
Fred
has
Sanders.
To do with the
was it Kevin Style or what's his name? Kevin somebody or another. I can't
Got
remember.
Me.
The one who came out and just said, if you believe in the eternal subordination of the Son, you are a anti-Nicene heretic. That guy.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name. It's Kevin something.
Kevin.
Yeah. I have your book on something in my office, but I can't remember his name. Anyway, see, that just goes to show why I can't even remember these people's names.
Yeah. I enjoyed that debate. I think it's a good debate. Go listen to that debate. Wayne Grudem and Bruce Ware versus two guys.
I'll find his name.
Yeah.
Keep talking.
But is he one of the guys that debated in that debate?
I don't remember.
But that's a good one. And, you know, the Trinity is a relevant, obviously, important issue. You know, there are a lot of cults. One way you know you're dealing sometimes with a cult is they do weird things.
Kevin Giles, not Styles, it's Giles. That's close.
Okay. but a lot of cults do weird things with the Trinity. So the Trinity is very important.
Very
obviously.
Delicate, dangerous so, topic. To
yeah, I remember when Norman Geisler came here to visit our school and to speak at our commencement program a few years ago. I was having dinner with him, and I said, I got a theory on the Trinity. Let me share with you my theory. And he's like, you better be careful. I was like, what? He said, you can't talk about the Trinity for more than 10 minutes without heresy. I was like, I've never forgotten that. But the Trinity is, simply put, a complex thing, very simply put, is one God who exists as three persons. So these are all things that we could have been discussing this entire time instead of the Calvinism debate.
And not just we, because our podcast isn't really about that debate,
right.
But we as
people,
in
yeah. And so,
the communities.
So we're done. We're done yeah. talking about this.
Yeah.
But I hope you have a great debate discussing Calvinism.
Well, discussing free will.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you next season, and hopefully you'll find some other stuff to talk about. We've had a great time. We've done all kinds of things. We've colored. We've done everything. Who knows what's coming next year?
We don't.
Maybe Jonathan will get saved. But visit us at trinitysem.edu,
wow.
trinitysem.edu. Visit me at braxtonhunter.com. Visit us at youtube.com/braxtonhunter. And wherever you got this, go back for more.